Blog Talk Radio.
You go busting your fist against the stone wall. You're not using your brain. That's what the white man wants you to do. Look at you. What makes you ashamed of being black?
Number love for you.
You know how hard it is.
No doubt.
Being a woman, a black woman
no
at that.
In this white man's world.
Sometimes we overlook the fact that we can ride hard in our city. We don't be knowing the pain we can cause.
It's white man's world.
It's white man's world. I ain't saying I'm innocent at all.
It's white man's world.
It's on. Yeah. Of all those times that I messed up, but we messed up.
Dear sister, got me twisted up in prison. I miss you. Crying, looking at my nieces and my nephews' picture. They say don't let this cruel world get you. Kinda suspicious, swearing one day you might leave me for somebody that's rich. Cap off the bottom, I take a sip and see tomorrow. Gotta make it if I have to beg a bottle. Beating love letters late night, locked down and quiet. Your brothers don't receive they mail, best believe we ride. Eating Jack Mack, staring at the walls, silent inside this cage where they captured all my ways and bottles. In time I learned a few lessons, never fall for riches. Apologies to my true sisters, far from bitches. Help me raise my black nation, reparations to do. It's true, caught up in this world, I took advantage of you. So tell the babies how I love them, precious boys and girls, born black in this white man's world.
And all I heard was,
to my homie's head, died in his vest. Shot him to death and left him bleeding for his family to see. I pass his casket, gently ask him, is there heaven for Jesus? My homeboy's doing life, baby mama be stressing, shedding tears when her son finally asked that question. Where my daddy at? Mama, why we live so poor? Why you crying? Heard you late night to my bedroom door. Now do you love me, mama? Why they keep on calling me nigga? Get my weight up with my hate and pay him back when I'm bigger. And still ducking in his jail cell, missing my block. Hearing brothers screaming all night, wishing they stopped. Proud to be black, but why we act like we don't love ourselves? So look around, but suck, check yourselves. Know what it means to be black, whether a man or girl. We still struggling in this white man's world.
White man's world.
We must fight for brotherhood.
Direction, and I'm thinking of an eye. My time away just made perfection. Cause I think I die. Not going wild, why should I care? Like we holding on the lost love that's no longer there. Can you please help me? God bless me, please keep my seeds healthy. Making all my enemies bleed while my G's wealthy. Hoping they bury me with ammunition, weed and shells. Just in case they trip in heaven, ain't no G's in hell. Sister, sorry for the pain that I caused your heart. I know I'll change if you help me, but don't fall apart. Rest in peace to Lil Tasha, Lil Yummy and Kato. Too much for this cold world to take, ended up being fatal. Every woman in America, especially black, stay with me, can't you see that we under attack? I never meant to cause drama to my sister and mama, but we make it to better times in this white man's world.
You're out of touch with reality. A few of you in a few smoke-filled rooms calling that the mainstream, while the masses of the people, white and black, red, yellow, and brown, poor and vulnerable, are suffering in this nation.
Bye.
Quo Ding, all the real OGs, we out.
The seal and the Constitution reflect the thinking of the founding fathers that this was to be a nation by white people and for white people. Native Americans, blacks, and all other non-white people were to be the burden bearers for the real citizens of this nation.
My name is Asada Shakur, and I was born and raised in the United States. I am a descendant of Africans who were kidnapped and brought to the Americas as slaves. I spent my early childhood in the racist, segregated South. I later moved to the northern part of the country, where I realized that black people were equally victimized by racism and oppression. I grew up and became a political activist, participating in student struggles, the anti-war movement, and most of all, in the movement for the liberation of African Americans in the United States. I later joined the Black Panther Party, an organization that was targeted by the COINTELPRO program, a program that was set up by the Federal Bureau of Investigation to eliminate all political opposition to the U.S. government's policies, to destroy the black liberation movement in the United States, to discredit activists, and to eliminate potential leaders. Under the COINTELPRO program, many political activists were harassed, imprisoned, murdered, or otherwise neutralized. As a result of being targeted by COINTELPRO, I, like many other young people, was faced with the threat of prison, underground, exile, or death. The FBI, with the help of local police agencies, systematically fed false accusations and fake news articles to the press, accusing me and other activists of crimes we did not commit. Although in my case the charges were eventually dropped or I was eventually acquitted, the national and local police agencies created a situation where, based on their false accusations against me, any police officer could shoot me on sight. It was not until the Freedom of Information Act was passed in the mid-70s that we began to see the scope of the United States government's persecution of political activists. At this point, I think that it is important to make one thing very clear. I have advocated, and I still advocate, revolutionary changes in the structure and in the principles that govern the United States. I advocate self-determination for my people and for all oppressed people inside the United States. I advocate an end to capitalist exploitation, the abolition of racist policies, the eradication of sexism, and the elimination of political repression. If that is a crime, then I am totally guilty. To make a long story short, I was captured in New Jersey in 1973 after being shot with both arms held in the air and then shot again from the back. I was left on the ground to die, and when I did not, I was taken to a local hospital where I was threatened, beaten, and tortured. In 1977, I was convicted in a trial that can only be described as a legal lynching. In 1979, I was able to escape with the aid of some of my fellow comrades. I saw this as a necessary step, not only because I was innocent of the charges against me, but because I knew that the racist legal system in the United States, I would receive no justice. I was also afraid that I would be murdered in prison. I later arrived in Cuba, where I am currently living in exile as a political refugee. The New Jersey State Police and other law enforcement officials say they want to see me brought to justice. But I would like to know what they mean by justice. Is torture justice? I was kept in solitary confinement for more than 2 years, mostly in men's prisons. Is that justice? My lawyers were threatened with imprisonment.
I just want to spend a minute talking about a couple of the, you know, some of the parallels between mass incarceration and Jim Crow, and then, you know, the end of that. Once I get started talking here, I can go. But consider some of the rules and laws that apply to those labeled felons today, and ask yourself if they remind you of a bygone era. Denial of the right to vote. Right? 48 states and the District of Columbia denied prisoners the right to vote. Now, mind you, that's not the case in other Western democracies. You know, in fact, in other countries, there are often voting campaigns within prisons. There's voting drives within prisons. In other democracies, you don't forfeit your citizenship when you go to prison. You're still a person. You're still a citizen. You're still part of that country, even if you're in prison. You get to vote. In the United States, nearly every state denies prisoners the right to vote, and that's just the tip of the iceberg, because then once you're released, you can be denied a right to vote for a period of years, maybe until your probation or parole expires, or for the rest of your life. It's up to the individual state. And nationwide, about 1 in 8 black men are either temporarily or permanently disenfranchised as a result of felon disenfranchisement laws. Exclusion from jury service. You know, one hallmark of the Jim Crow era, of course, was all-white juries, you know, particularly in the South. Well, these all-white juries have had a roaring comeback in recent years. Why? Well, in part because anyone convicted of a felony is considered automatically ineligible for jury service. Automatically ineligible for jury service. And then, get this. If you've ever had a negative experience with law enforcement, you could be struck from a jury for cause. You know, prosecutors able to persuade the judge that that negative experience that you have in law enforcement might bias your judgment in a criminal case. Now, good luck finding.
Right.
Many African Americans, particularly of Portuguese of color, who have not yet had a negative experience with law enforcement that conceivably biased them in a criminal case. So even in some areas with relatively large black populations, you see all-white or nearly all-white
jury. Today, officials decree that rapper Brad Jordan, alias Scarface, must be stopped. After being monitored by Secret Service agents for 2 years, evidence leads tobacco and firearms officials to believe that his literally dope lyrics promote drug usage and distribution, degrade women, influence gambling, promote and teach violence, and more importantly, it's influencing our minors and destroying our communities. Officials say he's the lord of underground rap. Him and his music must be stopped.
We got this whole motherfucker on the mission. Now the whole entire world has gotta try to come up with a quick decision. They claim we threats to society, and now they're calling on the government to try to make somebody quiet for the bullshit they done to me. Gangsta Nip Spice warned that Tupac never gave a gun to me. So gangsta rap ain't done shit for that. I've even seen white folks from River Oaks don't get to get. So why you trying to kick some dust up? America's always been known for blaming us niggas, but they fucked up. And we were always considered evil. Now they're trying to bust our only code of communicating with our people. Let's peep the game from a different angle. Matt Dillon pulled his pistol every time him when someone tangled. So why you criticize me for the shit that you see on your TV? That's freaks worse than PG. Just bring your ass to where they got me, so you can feel the hand of the dead body.
Nigga, don't believe that song. That nigga's wrong.
So now they trying separation and sending black folks in white coats to infiltrate our congregation, tapping into our conversation, taking the message that they get, bring forth wrong premeditation. So David's got a silver man. While listening to Brad, David gets pissed and killed his dad. David Duke's got a shotgun. So why you get upset? Cause I got one. A chisket, a tasket, a nigga got his ass kicked, shot in the face by a cop, close casket. An open and shut situation. Cop gets got, they wanna blame it on my occupation. If you don't dig me, then nigga, you can sue, because the shit that I be saying ain't worse than a Western movie. Don't blame me, blame your man, got it. So you can feel the hand of the dead body.
Nigga, don't believe that song, that nigga's wrong. Gangsters don't live that long.
You better free your mind before I free my nine and stop fucking with Detroit up top. I feel my hot rocks. Bang, bang, boom, boom, ping, ping. I'm the black, white boys got a magazine and don't know how to act. I attack and make you vomit. Down with Khaled, I do my homage. Dewey got a brother, I'm McNeil. I'm the illest. Wanna kill this house, nigga, Don Cornelius. Can you feel this? You punk niggas make me sick. Sucking on the devil, dick, scared of revolution. Need to start douching. Houston is the place. I caught a case. The motherfuckers tried to put a scar on my face. But I bust two times to the guts. Do the Reverend Calvin bust. Got a pair of nuts. I started this gangster shit in 86. Now you're dissing me for publicity. Isn't he a hoe to the third degree? Who me? I'm a G that like to scrap a lot. Down with rap a lot. And I can't stop, won't stop. So fuck Bill and Hillary. Ice Cube, it ain't no killing me. Ice Cube, Scarface, dropping it on these sellout ass niggas. Doing it like,
nigga, don't believe that song, that nigga's wrong. Gangsters don't live that long. Nigga, don't believe that song, that nigga's wrong. Gangsters don't live that long.
My mother, my father, sisters, my brother, Jonathan. They were intended to familiarize them with the situation I was faced with here. Of course, here in prison, we see the repression, the exploitation, the victimization of lower class.
In 61, Jackson was 19 years old, and he received the indeterminate sentence of 1 year to life.
Well, I was incarcerated under a one to life, a term they call for one to life, where I could have done 1 year and been released. I've done 10. That's more time than anybody in this state has ever done on a one to life. I went through all the processes. I tried to get out. I went to school, program. But now on the side, I was studying things that I felt would help the community.
Those on the right saw him as the most powerful threat in the prison system.
I think racism is a control device, control mechanism. Create an atmosphere whereby they can control inmates, control inmates. Black is just a continuation.
He was the true revolutionary, the black communist guerrilla in the highest state of development.
I'd be the last one to say that Johnson had suicide in mind. I'm certain that Johnson felt that the police would have some concern, would give some concern to the lives of those five civilians. I'm thinking that Johnson was trying to demonstrate to the public, to the people, just how he felt that these problems should be solved.
Was the incident for which you're charged now, was it a revolutionary act on your part?
You're asking me to confess to something?
Yeah. Unless happened. You wanted to. Did you kill a man?
Look, one of the most important elements of guerrilla warfare is to maintain secrecy. I haven't killed nobody until it's been proven. And they'll never be able to.
Know what I mean? It's war. Know what I mean? Yo, stick. I mean, shit be real on the block. Pigs be out there, occupied army. RBGs, it's a takeover, not a makeover. Yeah. The cops stop you just because you black, that's war. When you through the system for your prince, that's war. When they call my hood a drug zone, that's war. Slumlord charging you for rent, that's war. Why they so rich and we poor, that's war. If you young and black, you sell crack, that's war. The White House is the rock house, that's war. George Bush coming out his mouth, that's war. Chilling on the corner with your gang, that's war. Hope we'll do the same damn thing, that's war. When they murdered I'ma do the yellow, that's war. Marching in the streets is a strategy of war. Knowing self-defense is a strategy of war. Soldiers try to link with other soldiers in the war. Revolutionaries got to know the art of war. War, what about hip-hop? Use that. Matter of fact, fuck a rap battle. What about a gat battle? Let's take it to the beast and see which cat tattle. Is it kids versus beans, a bee versus hoe? What about y'all real niggas against the 5-0? This is M1, DP, don't you forget. Cause you can talk, 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 but that don't mean shit. I ain't gotta pop your top to see where your brains went. This rap shit is way bigger than entertainment. It's the people versus the pigs when it all go down. It's not pop versus big, it's who's getting the power. The power ain't money, dog, it's self-determination. Like taking hot and making it the real people station, that's war. Know what I mean? Yeah. Rap war, whatever war. You live a fast life, more or less, more so, it's still war. Dead prayers, the people radio. Yeah. Get down, get down, get down. RBGZ, biatch.
You are now listening to WRBG, the people's radio. It's a takeover, not a make.
When the revolution comes.
When the revolution comes.
When the revolution comes. When the revolution comes, some of us will probably catch it on TV with chicken hanging from our mouths. You'll know it's revolution because there won't be no commercial. When the revolution comes. When the revolution comes.
When the revolution comes.
Preacher pimps are gonna split the scene with the communion wine stuck in their back pockets. Faggots won't be so funny then, and all the junkies will quit their nod and wake up when the revolution comes. When the revolution comes, transit cops will be crushed by the trains after losing their guns, and blood will run through the streets of Harlem, drowning anything without substance when the revolution comes. When the revolution comes. When the revolution comes. I hope pearly white teeth fall off the mouths that speak of revolution without reference. The course of revolution is 360 degrees. Understand the cycle that never ends. Understand the beginning to be the end, and nothing is in between but space and time that I make or you make to relate or not to relate to the world outside my mind, your mind. Speak not of revolution until you are willing to eat rats to survive. When the revolution comes.
When the revolution comes.
When the revolution comes, guns and rifles will be taking the place of poems and essays. Black cultural centers will be forts supplying the revolutionaries with food and arms when the revolution comes. When the revolution comes, white death will fall the walls of museums and churches, breaking the lie that enslaved our mothers. When the revolution comes. When the revolution comes, Jesus Christ is going to be standing on the corner of Lenox Avenue and 125th Street, trying to catch the first gypsy cab out of Harlem. When the revolution comes. When the revolution comes, Jew merchants will give away matzo balls and gefilte fish to anyone they see with an afro. Frank Schiffman will give away the Apollo to the first person he sees wearing a blue dashiki. When the revolution comes,
when the revolution comes,
afros gonna be trying to straighten their heads, and straighten heads gonna be trying to wear afros. When the revolution comes, when the revolution comes,
when the revolution comes,
when the revolution comes. But until then, you know, and I know, niggas will party and bullshit and party and bullshit and party and bullshit and party and bullshit.
Liberation of oppressed people in the United States has to do not with climbing up some ladder to success,
not for asking to be just like Rockefeller or just like DuPont or just like Ford, because
Yahoo, Black Power, Black Power, Black Nation. You're tuned into In Defense of the People, two weekly Tuesday night broadcasts at 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, People's Political Party National Chair, Nat Turner, co-host, myself, National Minister of Defense, Brother Motherland, and our engineers on the ones and twos, National Minister of Communication, Sister Amina. Call in every Tuesday night, same black place, same black time at 845-277-9266. Press 1 to participate. Tonight's topic, black man scapegoat for crime in America, and that's America, KKKA. We're going to open up our phone lines to our national chairman, Nat Turner. Yahoo, comrade, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Right on, man. Word up. America, cup,
like
cup,
pop.
Cup. Right on. Small A-M-E-R-I. And hit that cap lock on your laptop. Three capital K's. And hit it again and take it off cap lock and type another E and you got America. That's a political stance that we take, and an attitude, political swag, if you will, to use the young folks' term today. You know, and it's political, the relationship that people of African descent have with what we refer to as the state. And again, the state is the politician, the businessman, the judge, and the police work hand in glove in a concerted effort, a tag team, if you will, of those who understand the showboat of wrestling for the purpose of keeping intact the structure of things in this country. Basically white male patriarchal rule. And so as part of that, we have this topic tonight. I guess I'll just start by how I got around to it. I was looking into something as usual because somebody has to do, from among us as black people, in order to convert our minds from bullshit to seriousness, from when you look at the larger society of black people, the black populace in this country, we can say converting blind rage into a consciousness of power in order to alleviate the ills that we suffer collectively on a daily basis in this country. So looking on YouTube, I've come across a documentary or type of video that was shot by this European in Fulton County, Georgia. Now, I don't know if he's a native Georgia or the country or whatnot. I would get the impression that he was not, because he had said that he had come to Fulton County, Atlanta, Georgia, to do a story, and that he chose this particular story about a brother named Brian Nichols, who some of us, if not most or all of us, may remember. 8 years ago, excuse me. 9 years ago, matter of fact, March 11, 2005, this brother had taking an action, which was a deadly one, against the state, and how he had gotten there is a very interesting. Some cases and parts of it's tragic. But that is how I arrived at this topic. The white boy chose to do his piece on him. And when he was explaining or what have you, this was for me the giveaway. When he had brought up where he was and story of Brian Nichols, and he had said there's a lot of crime that's going on here and whatnot. And so it's subtle. Those subtle messages, sublime language, that this term sublime or subtle is used in certain circles among certain types of people, and particularly in Freemasonry. I mean, speaking subtle, sublime language. And I felt that this was an opportunity once again on the part of white people in general, white males in particular, to do exactly what the topic is tonight: black man scapegoat crime in America. And so wanna go over what happened with Brian Nichols, to give you an idea of the story. And of course, YouTube is an international outreach, what we refer to as a form of media, where people from around the world can see your material. And that in itself is problematic when it comes to imagery, the imagery in particularly of black men, of the black man here specifically in America, let alone in other parts of the world, such as Africa, India, and other places. 2005, March 11, Brian Nichols had killed the equivalent of 4 people as a result of a trial that was pending. He had been held previously for 6 months, or at the time, on a rape charge and some other things with a former girlfriend of his. This brother come from a what would be considered a middle class family, or whatever, middle class environment, or what have you. These hierarchical terms that are used in the structure, but it come from that background and have been doing been doing good. Played football. He had met a sister, and they got together like two other, persons do, better relationship, whatnot. The girl, she, successful and all right. And, as any other relationship, there's problems, whatnot, there's nothing out of the ordinary when it comes to our relationships in this country. As a matter of fact, it's the norm. But, one thing led to the next little things. The media would give the impression that he had start becoming wayward. It started coming off the tracks and developing some type of mental issues and whatnot. Of course, there's always the person who's telling the story, the one who's controlling the narrative. And let me say this, by the way, I didn't even watch the whole documentary. I think it's somewhere around an hour or something like that, whatever. I didn't even watch it. Just off of instinct from my experiences, you know, taking a look, researching, you know, delving into shit, you know, looking into things, you know, so my people can be made to understand things that other groups, you know, are private to what have you, you know. But, yeah, so, you know, their relationship began to deteriorate some, according to the girl, the sister, I think, like, the first time he cheated on her or whatever, you know. And then, you know, she, you know, was like, she's done and whatnot. And I think that she may have, as black women, known to do somehow, some kind of way, which is beyond me sometimes, to forgive, which is the God in them, about as close as I can come to try to explain it. But anyway, eventually they connected again, but at some she started seeing some other guy in his mind, you know, that was unacceptable and whatnot, led, you know, the other things that, you know, were not on the positive at times as far as, you know, they're just seeing each other, period. And so according to the account, you know, they wind up getting together one more time or what have you. It appears to be, you know, that the sister may have agreed. And, but anyway, that is the account is that he had come over and what have you, or they were in a place and he had, you know, tied her up and whatnot, duct tape, whatever. You know, he did, you know, I guess certain things too, whatever. But the chief thing of this was, well, you know, these charges about being held against your own will, you know, which would be verge on kidnapping and abuse and whatnot. I don't know if it's threatened bodily harm, but anyway, it was the rape charge that was the main, you know, thing here. And so he had, went to trial, and they could not convict him. It was 8-4, not guilty, and so this thing about a hung jury. So it appears that, you know, they were out to get a conviction. One of the jurors later went on record saying that the initial trial, it appears that the juror himself had sort of developed a preconceived notion of guilt already. And this is from his own mouth. But the one thing that was interesting about what he said was, you know, he was looking for something to change his mind, even though the fact that the defense had dismantled or demolished much or most of the evidence that the police produced, the investigation. And so this is what led to this so-called hung jury. And so keeping him in prison, quote unquote, it obviously had some type of effect on him. And so they were seeking a conviction, and therefore a second trial. And so it was at this point the second trial, when on the day of, you know, he was being held in a one of the holding cells and whatnot, you know, inside the court building or near the court building and whatnot. And also it was a thing about him having had been found on his person, I think one or two metal shanks that he had made from some kind of from a doorknob or something. And so this concerned the judge and whatnot was something about making sure that it had, you know, extra security and stuff. So it was always, it was already this thing, a perception of him. See, of course, the juror was pointing out how his whole operation was in the court, where he would look the jurors in the eyes and whatnot, you know, and smile. And, you know, in his testimony, he said that the sex was consensual and whatnot, stuff like that. But the juror was just pointing out word intimidation and stuff like that. But anyway, so it was a female guard that had been given the responsibility to transfer him from the holding cell and into the court. And it's at this point, you know, he was being unhandcuffed to change clothes, is when he caught the female guard, you know, what people say off guard. He overpowered her physically and managed to get his hands on a weapon. And so this is when his mind had been made up. And the first thing that was on his mind was the judge. And so he had made his way to the court and he encountered several people with the weapon and, you know, forced them to disclose which court that the judge was in and whatnot. And so he, you know, made his way there. There's a number of things that he did. One deputy or whatever person who had, you know, was security, radio, and he had managed to get a hold of the radio to defuse the situation, you know. But at this point, he made his way, you know, to the judge's chamber, and he went in, and this is when he started shooting. So he went into the court, he shot the judge. Then he shot the court reporter, who I believe is a female. And so after that, his attempt to escape. And in this escape, he encountered a sheriff, Hoyt, in which he got the better of the draw and shot this deputy, who I believe had been a ranking officer. And so he got outside, managed to escape, flee the area. And in the midst of that, encountered a law enforcement officer who I believe works, you know, with the group called ICE. And so he beat this officer, law enforcement officer, to the draw. And so that's the fourth person that he shot and killed. And so fleeing, he had managed to steal several cars. And he changed from one vehicle to the next and stuff like that. And he had made his way to Duluth, Georgia, at an apartment complex where he encountered one Ashley Smith, a white girl. And he had took her hostage in her own apartment. And he had been, you know, sought for several hours. You know, even the next day. And so after all that had taken place, of course, there was a manhunt. The story made the that television show, was it America's Most Wanted or whatnot, you know. It was sensationalized all over the news. He was, projected as a cold-blooded murderer and a rapist. And so they had been in the apartment for quite some time. The next morning, she actually made this brother pancakes. And so they would, according to her, would talk and discuss and talk. And she, there's a book that she had. And this book was one of those books that, people write these books about, spirituality, persons who've changed their lives around, those who have become born again Christians and have accepted Jesus as their Lord and Savior. And, these books are written by people. There's also books that are written by those who consider themselves to be authorities and how to get your life back in order. So she had this book, and she would read this book to him. There's a movie that was made about Ashley Smith. Okay. And in the movie, there's a point where they go out driving. Can't quite remember. They're going something, gas station or something, but they were out. And Tig pulled them over, whatever. And, she defused the situation, and they were able to keep going and make it back. And also she herself had a drug addiction. She had a drug problem. And so in the midst of that, she had, offered him, given him a meth. So whether or not that was her ploy or strategy, to escape and whatnot, stuff like that. There's interviews or whatever, that you may, those who listen, maybe to see online and whatnot, and she tells stories. But the story that she gives and the image that's portrayed of him is, two different things. Because, there were those who asked if he was such a cold-blooded murderer and a rapist, then how come he didn't harm her? So much so to the point when she had a daughter or something, or two or children, and he actually let her leave to go see her children. And it's at that point, when she left the apartment, that she, of course, got outside with him, and she called the police. And that is how they were able to apprehend him, with no problem, with no nothing. You see, but, they had been talking, and you don't make a murderer and a racist pancakes. That's not what's going to be on their minds, and it's the imagery. It's the imagery that's painted. And sometimes our people have trouble trying to pick that up because they're being subjected to a crime, someone who senselessly murdered innocent people, And of course, this may be problematic for some. This may be problematic for some people. But I'm going to go into something else about him in a minute. But him being apprehended with no problems and brought in, and of course being held, whatever, for these crimes that get committed. When they had tallied up the whole thing, he had faced over 50 charges for all of these, for his actions. A lot of that is problematic. What I mean by that is, it's not to take away from, what he'd done to the system. But he had begun to see that, he was doomed, or may have begun to understand that in having a second trial. Now, there are reporters and journalists and writers or whatever, you know, who will write these stories. You know, some of it may be accurate, you know, but we can never trust the media wholeheartedly. You know, but there's an article written about this brother in the Atlanta Journal Constitution. And for those who may be interested, the article is True Confession, the Day Brian Nichols Fessed Up. And so I wanted to read from some of the article in order to put in the context what we're saying here as far as his actions. One second here. There was a police detective named Vincent Velasquez. Okay. And trying to get past all the bullshit here. You see, the article is almost like rocket science now these days. To try to get a hold of some of this information. But the interesting thing about that is that he had a conversation with this Velasquez when he was being transported. He had gotten to the point where he even getting a little sarcastic with Velasquez to the point where he said his name in syllables, whether or not he was trying to refer to him as an ass, because he said Velasquez like that. And so you said they had a conversation, and according to this Velasquez, that Nichols had commented that it was surreal to stand over a Superior Court judge still sitting in his chair with a bullet hole in his head, a shell casing on his robe, he recalled. Court reporter Julie Brandeis' body lay a few feet away. As Nichols was being held at FBI headquarters in DeKalb, Velasquez worried that the Fed would Bigfoot Atlanta Police Department on investigation, some type of terminology that they use. Well, anyway, you know, they go on and on and on and on and on in the conversation. And this Velasquez figured that Nichols hadn't eaten and let him overhear his phone conversation. Then, acting like he was impolite and not including Nichols, Velasquez asked, "Oh, would you like something?" Sure, Nichols said he'd have the same. And so this type of cat and mouse like kind of thing is going on. Then he said, "I called the Atlanta Police Department detective last week to ask about the debriefing. The most memorable thing is, the first thing he said to me was, now check this out. Check this out. Listen to this here. This is the most memorable thing that Officer Velasquez stuck in his head what Nichols had told him. The most memorable thing is, the first thing he said to me was, quote, I want to give my condolences to the families of those killed in combat. Let me say that again. Let me read it again. I want to give my condolences to the families of those killed in combat. The transcript bears Velazquez out almost word for word. Nichols was being retried on charges that he raped his former girlfriend, and the trial was going badly for him. The defendant knew he'd likely go away for a long time. He had nothing to lose. Now, this is the, you know, the reporter writing that part right there. Now, the question is, why did he make the statement that he had killed in combat? And he had, you know, apologized and condolences to the families of those that he harmed. Now, as I said, I didn't watch the whole document. I just watched the front part of this white boy's little thing on Brian Nichols. And I read some of a lot of the comments and whatnot. And you can pretty much tell, you know, just by reading who's white and who's not in some instances, in most instances. You know, of course there are some blacks who, you know, show disdain for him also, you know, and that's all right. But how had he gotten to the type of response in his mind to be conscious enough to make that comment about those killed in combat? That is not a usual thing when someone who's murdered person or person or whatnot, they usually say. It's not something that's usually said. And so if I was a betting man, and I don't bet, but if I was a betting man, I'd be willing to bet that the white boy who did the documentary report failed to quote from this conversation that Nichols had with Velazquez. Now, as we say that the state is the politician, the judge, businessman, the judge, and the police, you know. And so in his mind, it was a war against the state. And then particularly, one of the four who represent the state was the judge. And so his mother had ended up going on a Oprah Winfrey show, something where Oprah has this Where Are They Now thing. And so Oprah had, you know, got his mother to come on the show, and the one and only Ashley Smith, who also cashed in on the reward. It was a reward, I believe, $50,000 to $60,000 that was put out on him. And so his mother, you know, talking and discussing it and questioning, and she, you know, she said she regularly goes to see her son, and, you know, like any other mother would. And so the interesting thing was his mother had brought up one conversation that she had with Nichols. And she said that trying to understand, you know, and let alone, the, you know, the rest of the world or the country or those who had gotten wind on that day, you know, the story had been put out nationally. And as always, there's this trying to understand why he did what he did. Well, according to his mother, Nichols had become convinced, being held captive and being transported, you know, in the prison garb and, you know, the shackles and, you know, him and a whole lot of other so-called inmates walking and chained together. And he had began to see that as reminiscent of slavery, according to his mother, that the system was reminiscent of slavery, and how he saw the judge and the chains and the shackles, and how the slaves, the same way, were shackled, and that it was one big plantation. You know, and this is what his mother was saying, that in the conversation that he disclosed to her, you see. And so he had began to see it in another context. Even though he did what he did to his girlfriend, he began to see it in another context, you see. And so this is what drove him, you know, to take out an action. Now, this type of language, this type of expression, phrase, object, whatever you want to call it, you know, this is something that's in terms of war, struggle, guerrilla struggle, revolutionary struggle, and what have you, which is historic. You know, some of the brothers and sisters back in the 60s, you know, would use that word. And some of these brothers and sisters, you know, were still alive, who going around and spoken around the country and whatnot, and telling some of their things that they did, and they used the word action. And so this is what Brian Nichols had declared. This is what he had in his mind. This is what his psychology had become. This is the conclusion that he had drawn, and this is the linchpin to his actions. And so this is why, after his actions were carried out, a sort of mini war, if you will. And this is why he was speaking to Velasquez, that he wanted to express his condolences to the families of those who were killed in combat. You see, and when you you know, you develop this type of thinking, especially a black man, when his mind begins to change over, convert over. And this may sound odd, strange to some people, but it's a certain angle that's being taken on a deeper type of understanding, or as a revolutionary, as a politically conscious, or even a prisoner of war. You know, those who are still being held as prisoners of conscience, POWs, behind enemy lines, they will speak in terms of war, where black men are the enemy combatants of the state, not that black men are somehow citizens of a democracy, who are innocent until proven guilty, or who have due process of the law, who have the same constitutional rights and protections as white men. And so Nichols had escalated his thought process by becoming conscious over the imagery of something that has been historic, the treatment, of black men. Now, there's been cases many times historically where black men who have been convicted of a crime didn't think that they would have a fair trial, didn't think that they would get a fair trial in court. This is nothing new. You know, black men who were innocent back doing reconstruction on into Jim Crow, convicted of crimes that they had not committed. Not only convicted of crimes that they committed, but actually put to death, sentenced to death for crimes that they had not committed, because they had no confidence in the system. You know, they had no faith in the judicial system of the courts. You know what they call being railroaded in court. You know, and this is the type of mentality that Brian Nichols had taken on, which led to his actions. Okay, and some people say, "Well, I hear you, but you've made the sister who he harmed disappear." And that's not what's being done here. You know, yes, any brother who harms a black woman physically, rape or what have you, deserves to get his ass knocked off, straight up. You know, so we wouldn't be that foolish to harp on him so much to where the sister becomes invisible. And so we just want to make that clear for the record. But this whole thing of doing the story on him and in this white boy's subconscious, knowing that he's a white male, and they may deny, and they will deny this, but we understand it as a historic process in the white male's subconscious. Okay, and so to constantly alleviate white male violence, or to what's the word I'm looking for here? To turn the imagery, or distort the imagery, or the scapegoat, you know, is what we say. You know, this white boy uses Brian Nichols as the quintessential example of crime in America, the most severe type of crime, murder. Okay, this is what we're getting here. And while we're doing that, we're also putting in the context his actions and the reasons for his actions. The reasons for his actions. Okay, and so around the world, this imagery is picked up. I encountered a brother, and I can call him a brother, from India. Basically, the only difference that we had was head texture. As a matter of fact, he was dark-skinned, very dark-skinned, and darker than me. And I encountered this brother when I was marooned in Houston as a result of Hurricane America, leaving one of the, you know, the upscale malls or areas, and we were both at a bus stop, and somehow some kind of way we started talking, and so I'm looking at him, and I'm, you know, and like my conscious level is like, you know, ask him where he's from, you know, because I'm looking at his physical characteristics, and he's real dark skinned, you know, and I had a hunch, I said, well, I had the business from India, so I started talking to him, and he was like, yeah. And it shifted over to black people in America. And he said that he had come to America. He had said where he's from. He said where he's from, you know, and the media, Western media, you know, that the media that, you know, that they're bombarded with is Western media. And so, he said that a huge part of that, or a noticeable part of it, is the image of black people in America as the criminals, as all the things that have gone wrong in America. It's the niggas' fault that this country is seen as violent and, you know, all this type of shit. And so he said it's been very effective on the minds of Indian people. And he said, so what he decided to do, and this must have been instinctual, but what he said he decided to do was to take a trip to America to come see for himself. And so he said when he got here, he said the first thing that he did was, you know, in terms of going out and hanging out and whatnot and going places and venturing here and there, was going to clubs, bars where black people hang out. He said, so that's what he, you know, had been doing, going to these spots where black. And he said, after so long, he had been here at least probably a month or so or something like that, you know. But so far, you know, we had gathered, just going to all the different places. And he said he just didn't go to just one spot. Like, he said, he went to different places and at times where he thought, you know, this might not be a good idea. But he said everywhere he had went, he had met, you know, a lot of people, whites and Asians and things and what have you. But in his view, in his opinion, so far the people that he had met, the kindest, the nicest, the most respectful people were black people. And that he had begun to start questioning all of the imagery, all of the news that had been flashed across, his television, the TV back at home in India. And he began to realize that Western media was racist. And this is what he's telling me. You know? And so this is an example of the international harm of the black male image around the world. And as I said, this is no more, no less than an attempt on the part of this white boy to continue something that his forefathers have been doing in his subconscious. You know, now there may be those, well, he's actually a nice guy and whatnot. okay, well, we don't know if he did a piece on, you know, a white, you know, mass murder, whatever you want to call it. And we're going to get into that too, this redefining of mass shootings. And we really have to understand how powerful propaganda is. It's so powerful that it has had an effect on us within our own group, to where older brothers, brothers from my generation, brothers who come before me, have developed such disdain for the younger generation, for the younger brothers. They have been affected by the same type of propaganda, the same type of what we can refer to as psychological war. And, of course, the class issues will come into play. Brothers who, you know, who have been successful or able to live in what they refer to as nice neighbors, a middle-class neighbor, and whatnot. And so, therefore, you internalize these white class antagonisms that have become us now, you know. And so it's a very detrimental episode in our existence in this country as black males in particular. And, of course, what type of effect does it have on black women? Maybe even more drastic effect on black women. You know? But when we talk about crime all across the board, according to their statistics, and sometimes I have a bit of skepticism even there, but there are times when you can tell there are these moments, these times when the Europeans, in their collection of records and statistics, run into some rather difficult moments when it comes to crime, you see. But most crime in America, is committed by white people. When you talk about drug usage, you know, the whole thing, you know, pedophilia, all of these different things that have marred this country. You know, as I mentioned, you know, these shows that come on, and these shows that come on, you know, America's Most Wanted, but there's another one. I can't particularly think of the title of these other shows, but they come on in like the wee hours of the night where they show these, you know, unsolved mysteries and crimes and whatnot, and you look and you see most of these episodes are show white people, show white men, show white women who've plotted against, you know, their husbands and fathers and mothers, you know. And so we wonder how much is that put out by these white people who want to cover crime, put out stories and whatnot. Is that making it around the world? It could be, but there's this sense that we tend to pick up here. You know, when crime begins to take on a different imagery when it comes to non-whites. And so therefore, the majority of the people who are being held captive in these concentration camps as prisoners of war, unconscious and conscious prisoners of war, are black and brown people. Yet the whites are the ones who commit most of the crimes. So we know there's a problem. We know there's a methodical problem. You know, and so this is the scapegoating of the white criminal behavior. And there's several persons who have come along in our midst, such as Amos Wilson, who our youth are not really familiarized with. You know, Dr. Francis Chris Wilson, who taught at Howard University, who hasn't gotten the type of attention as other psychologists who have not been invited on in her days, were not invited on the CNNs and the Foxes and the MSNBCs back in the day in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s up to 2000, you know, not invited on these major media outlets to explain black crime, why he did it, psychology, as what they did when Dylan Klebo shot up the school. They pulled out the best white sociologists that they could find, slash psychiatrists, psychologists, to explain his actions. In some cases, done to win sympathy for him, which in essence would actually affect a criminal procedure. You know, of course, there would be those whose loved ones were his victims, screaming for the death penalty and whatnot, you know. Dr. Frances Gus Wilson wrote a book called ISIS Papers, and she would explain, the psychology of white supremacy. An extraordinary book, and I recommend anybody who want to understand white supremacy and its effect on the whole scheme of things, where she would make these diagrams and speak about the different sectors of American society, sports, entertainment, religion, business, politics, racism, of course, government, and all the other things that make up the American pie. And she would place each one of them in context, and she would reveal these things. There's the book is composed, we could say, of essays that she had written, since the 70s. The 70s, probably the 80s, the book was published, years ago. But it's still relevant today. But there's a section in there where one of her essays is titled, what is the motherfucker and the original motherfucker. This is the title of one of her essays that she wrote. And when you read the essay, it penetrates, your dome, it resonates in your brain. And you begin to understand the relationship that black men have with the state. You see, people talk, black men always crying as victims, always crying about being the victim of this, that, and the other. And then those who have come out on this have vehemently denounced this victimization thing. To a certain point of view, they may have an ounce of legitimacy in it. You see? But she would psychoanalyze the whole pie. And as a result of that, she never got the type of national media platform as the black liberals. She paid her dues to belong to the black academic intelligentsia. She had her credentials, but they wouldn't choose her when it came to having a discussion on race, a town hall meeting, where they invite someone who has a less of a sting than Dr. Wilson. So she would travel and speak around, black campuses, black universities and colleges, to try to raise the conscious level of the sector of our youth who were trying to, earn degrees on these campuses, these institutions. We are all institutionalized in some way, shape, or form. You see, when I speak about Dr. Amos Wilson, a very, very, very critical thinker, following in the footsteps of Malcolm X. He took violence and he placed violence in the context that's not usually placed by other, black male intellectuals. Even today, the ones who are projected onto us who have access, 24-hour access to CNN, Fox, and CNBC, regardless if Hannity don't like niggas, whatever, you know, out in the open, you know, Anderson Cooper 360 and whatnot, Don Lemon, you know, 24-hour access, the Michael Dysons of the world, Eric Michael Dysons of the world, Cornel West, Lamont Hill, who you may be able to see. What is the Black News Network or something like this? You know, there's this cable thing, you know, he's featured on his place at the space on there. You know what I'm saying? But they can hold Dr. Amos with a jockstrap. You know, you listen to him speak, and even myself, you know, I didn't really heard of him. You know, coming up through the ranks, understanding and learning. You know, participating in the struggle, you know, becoming conscious, you know, of myself as a Black man in this country. You see what I'm saying? But you may be able to see, see some of his old. I'm not too comfortable. I don't feel it does him any justice to refer to him speaking as speeches. It's more of a political education pieces that he would do, but he would speak on violence and crime and the white male patriarchal psychosis. This was the brother that said that in order to understand Black people, you must understand the history of white people. So I never heard these ones, those who have been projected onto us back in the 80s and 90s, the Al Sharptons of the world, you know, all these different individuals who are projected out, these National Black Caucus person who go around and speak and whatnot, you know. So it's certain individuals that they don't allow you to come in contact with through the media. We have to search high and low ourselves to come across people who really understand this shit, who can really get us to see, you know. And he was correct, you know. When you look at Black people, you know, white man in blackface, you know, the nigga mentality. Chuck D did a song called "Can You Kill the Nigga in You?" You know, Isaac Hayes, we talking about, you know, Isaac Hayes always spoke in such an eloquent way, you know. You know, we talking about don't be so socially necessitized thinking you got a rock when you only got a pebble. And what's he saying here? He's saying is you were made to believe that you have a rock, piece of the rock, but you only got a pebble. You know, you've yet to achieve this fantasy, this utopian ideal of freedom of having a rock. You see, without any struggle. Frederick Douglass, cool, we talking about Black people won't land without thunder, you know. And so the historical legacy of violence and crime in this country. And there are those who find it problematic. I was watching something else. It was an older brother who had been wrongly convicted. Spent 30, 40 years peeled up. You need concentration camp. When he went to speak before this so-called august body, and I get that from Minister Farrakhan. you know, they had these sham hearings, you know, the Senate subcommittee on this and all this kind of bullshit, you know, where they prodded people out in front, you know, and put on this kangaroo court thing to somehow, some kind of way, win Black people's faith back into the system. And not only Black people, there's so many gullible and naive white people, dumb as a brick, yet to profess to be, according to their IQ research, studies and numbers, profess to be smarter than everybody else. You know, if the Chinese, the East Asians don't have anything to say about it, you know, even them, You know, but this brother, when he was placing a shooting incident in the proper context, Chicago and whatnot, what did this brother say? He said, look, he said, I spent X amount of so-and-so with a crime I didn't commit. He said, you take crime. He said, yeah, you know, you're going to throw them away. You lock them up, throw them away. You're going to throw the book at him. He said, you know, you're talking about violence, and like you don't understand violence. He said, but it's so many ways he was saying it's the American way. He said, but he said this here. He said, as a matter of fact, he said, this country was founded on violence. And he spoke in front of these people. And you can only imagine what they was thinking themselves when he was saying what he was saying. But nobody in that room dared challenge him. Nobody in there, these so-called lawmakers, you know, the people that the rest of everybody else have poured their faith into to do the right thing, to write up legislation to make this country great, to write up legislation to reform things and all the neoliberalism, you know, to straighten things out. Jesse Jackson would tell us back in the day, you know, to keep hope alive, you know, up with hope and down with dope. You know, when it is as far as from the truth, it's so utopian. People have come in our midst, have made millions of dollars with these slogans. They have come and exploited the conditions, the material conditions, which lead to the concrete realities that we face collectively every day. And subjected to the blowback from that. You see, when, as a matter of fact, that the dope trade is the proprietorship of whom? It's a hierarchy from the top down. You know, the money trickle down. You know, and so you see all these cases, the brothers being constantly kidnapped on a daily basis. You know, for drug charges in New York. What did Rockefeller do? Nelson Rockefeller was the governor. What did he declare? Come up with, you know, these laws, these draconian laws, these Rockefeller laws. What is draconian? What does draconian mean? Draconian is a term that is really rooted in the word Draco. Okay, and of course, now how we know, you know, in the street, we understand what a Draco is. You know, and it's a, I'm telling you, it's fascinating how these words, these terminologies come into play, unconsciously sometimes, you know, but in the subconscious of the streets, of black people, or whoever, you know, in our look of the words, understand what a Draco is. And for the simple fact that Draco was a lawmaker, he was a ruler in Rome. And his name was Draco. And so Draco was iron-fisted to protect what? His assets, his position within Romish society, which reduced what? Which reduced who? Spartacus. And they've made movies about this Spartacus. As a matter of fact, they've remade Spartacus. And he's glamorized, he's romanticized as the man who initiated the falling or the destruction of the powerful Roman Empire. And so Draco, during this time, he would create these laws, these vicious laws, you know, to keep society straight. There was two classes of people. These terms that they used to apply to themselves, you know, the patrician class. Yeah, the patrician class. You know, the patrician class is the same base root as the word patriarch, patriarchal. And the word patriarchal, patrician, has the same root as the word father, which in Latin, Greek, is the word pater, P-A-T-E-R, or the aura in front of the A. And if you take the word, the letter P, and the F is basically the same. This is where they get the word frater from. And from frater, you get the word fraternity. And this is a white male patriarchal, which is a historical phenomenon. And it's a continuation. Rome is a continuation of Greece. And the treatment of women in Greece and the Greek city-states were constantly at war. Violence was the order of the day. But there was a particular class that would always advise those who were the rulers, the Caesars, or these so-called kings, Alexander, the so-called great, you know, the Ptolemies, you know, who were the rulers. And when they would have a dilemma, they had a particular group set aside that they would turn to help them figure out a dilemma. And this was the boule. And so now we today, we got a boule in our midst. Within the academic world, the black college circuit, you know, the fraternities and whatnot. And so all these things are connected. So from Draco on down to Rockefeller. Rockefeller is just the descendant, the ideological descendant of Draco, which is why they call the Rockefeller laws, which what disproportionately affects who? Black and brown people. And there's always this thing, something always affecting black people disproportionately. So how did it get to be disproportionately if we're only 12 to 13% of the population? Now, the numbers may be up. But if you throw the Latinos, Mexican, then the majority of the people in this country now is people of color. And so when you take that into consideration, crime is made to look like what? You know, in order to further, for the system to keep perpetuating itself. And so America's imagery around the world is supposed to be what? The leaders of democracy, the leaders of the free world. You know? And so the cat is out the bag. Other nations now are picking up on the bullshit. Other nations are aware when you get down to national, what is it, conditions. You know, it's known now around the world that America has the highest concentration of POWs in the world. America has the highest concentration of all kind of shit, highest rates of divorce. But this crime thing, the phenomenon of crime, has to be placed in the context of where America is trying to constantly re-image itself. And so the latest trick, the latest scheme, the latest tactic, the latest ploys to do what? The latest strategy to do what? Is to redefine mass shootings. Now, historically, mass shootings were what? Dylan Klebo and all these other mothers who shot up school, the white boy with the orange hair, I believe, shot up the theater. You know, the white boy that went up in the elementary school recently. You know, and if you look at that school, if you take that school into consideration, you will see that it has a, if not the majority of the students were people of color. So, or it has a heavy concentration of Latino students. The student body has a heavy Latino student body. You see, and the one in my own assessment, my personal assessment, what I began to conclude was when the lack of response time and how these law enforcement officers botched the whole thing and they're releasing the camera footage, the surveillance footage from the ceiling and showing how these officers that went up in there and, you know, they were in disarray, they weren't organized and whatnot, you know. And, you know, the response time. And these parents believe that had they moved in a much more reasonable time or much more fashionable response, then he wouldn't have had the chance to kill as many as he did. And so one of the things that come to my consciousness was that had that been a white school, an all-white student body or 95 to 99% white student body in the upscale white neighborhood, would the response time have been different? Would they have stormed in there, you know, way much quicker? And so see, it's in the subconscious. This is what we have to look at. We have to take a look at the white male patriarch's subconscious, in his mind, in the depths of his, in the darkness of his mind, which is his subconscious. Which, if it's planted there, then it comes out into manifestation into his actions, and this is the lack thereof. This is the lack thereof, the response time. And so people pretend to not try to see this angle, which is what Amos Wilson and Dr. Francis Crest Wilson would have made known to us had they been given the opportunity to go on seeing it and not be held in checks and balances by the state. You know? So mass shootings historically have been what? You know? Now, what is mass shootings now? What was the turning point? What was the trigger? All of a sudden, mass shootings now have a non-monolithic picture, definition, or image now. Now mass shootings include what and who? Mass shootings now include shootings, murders that go on in these little occupied colonies where black people have been concentrated. So if this image is shot around the world internationally, the image will go slowly but surely from thinking about a Dylan Klebo, and that name, it sticks in my head, you know. There's a white boy that made a documentary. He had a little buzz at some point. I can't remember his name. One of the documentaries, more recently, was titled Dude, Where's My Country? But the one that really got a lot of people was when he made this documentary called Bowling for Columbine. If you haven't seen it, check it out. In that documentary, he brings up the racial factor. And I actually didn't think that he would have the temerity to do it. But he brings up the racial factor when he brings up the thing about guns. Right? So he did his homework. He goes back into what Malcolm taught us, to go back in history. So he pulled up Malcolm, put it in the documentary. And as he made it, when he got to that part where he starts to talk about black people and the legacy of guns, he did it in the form of a cartoon. Right? And man, I got to remember this. I want to remember the key things here. Just bear with me. But he did it in the form of a cartoon. So when he goes back, he starts to talk about, oh, let's take a look at the history of gun laws and how they come about and how they, at intervals every now and then, they changed. So what did he do? He goes back to slavery. And he talks about the treatment of the whites, slave masters, the whites in general, and how they treated the blacks who were the slaves, who they did what, who they used to build the infrastructure, the capitalist structure here. How did they do it? They held them under the gun. And so the mistreatment had become a lasting memory, a lasting thing in the psyches of the subconscious of black people. And so when black people were so-called free, right, thanks to Abraham Lincoln, dead and stinking, he had said that in the subconscious of the whites, also that the blacks, because of what they knew what they did them, the era of guilt and the blowback from it, that in their subconscious they knew that by right that the blacks somehow, some kind of way, one day would rise up and avenge what the whites did them. And so they went and start making up these gun laws. And the same type of mentality, the same psychology that go and make these gun laws, is the same psychology mentality that has Stand Your Ground in Florida. And the incident where the white boy murdered, you know, shot up the young brother was the gas station, and he was declared he stood his ground. The open carry in certain states. That is the same mentality that came out of slavery. And so they create, be able to create these gun laws, to make these gun laws. So who won't have them? The niggas. So we come forward, what do we get in space and time? When the Black Panther Party formed, began to become conscious, the situation, the conditions, and we realized that the state was not capable, on purpose, for a purpose, but, to protect black people, Black Panther Party emerged as a Black Panther Party of self-defense. And they had known the gun laws, the constitutional rights, the bear arms and whatnot. Huey P. Newton would reel off the whole amendment, the whole ordinance in the state of California in these encounters with the pigs, and how he even got to be called the pigs in the first place. So what did they do? They made a move to do what? To disown the Black Panther Party, to change the gun laws of the state of California about open carry. And this is what the white boy in Bowling for Columbine was pointing out. And of course, he ticked off a lot of his own people. You know, but it would go no further than semi-militant white liberalism, apologetic white liberalism to the blacks for what the other whites had done. And then he talks about how lax the gun laws and how easy it is, you know, and whatnot. And he points out that one of these states where it was like some type of if you do this, do that, or whatever, then you could get a free rifle. You know. And this is a type of legacy, the history, you know, that goes into the white criminal behavior and the blowback from it. But at the same time, to mask it in another vein. So mass shootings is the new thing. Mass shootings is the new thing. Because they understand that the wheel, once it was made to start turning, after Jim Crow, understand what I'm saying? The wheel, once it was made to start turning after Jim Crow, this wheel of what? This cycle of what? Black on black violence. Once that wheel was made to start turning, and to keep the wheel turning through what? Several mechanisms or machinations. The dope trade, unemployment, desegregation. And there are those who would beg to differ. And I would just simply say, well, when they actually had a segregated, in the sense we appear to have had more businesses then, or there were businesses that actually thrived. And of course, come to mind, even with that, would be the Black Wall Street. And look what happened to that. And so this will, no one going into the future, would speed up. It would become. It would speed up so much that it would verge on wanton violence. WANTON, wanton violence, barbarism, animalism, and to speed it up. For what? To keep the structure intact. And of course, this thing about black males missing from the home, whatnot. Yeah, he's missing. He's supposed to be missing. What do you think? He's supposed to be missing. That's the whole purpose of it all, for him to be missing. And so, all you making excuses. Let's go look at Ireland and see if we're making an excuse. Again. When they examine the conditions of the Irish, what do they do? They pull out all the psychologists, pull out the psychiatrists, the sociologists, everybody. They'll pull out political economists to explain the lowly conditions of the Irish and when crime just rose up overnight. As a result of what? British imperialism. These are facts. These are conditions. You have to create the material condition in order to achieve concrete realities. What are those concrete realities? The animalism that we're seeing now. So we, those of us who are conscious as politicized revolutionists, we see it as a war within the war. And this war within the war that prepares for a greater war. That some people know you strike fear in them. You know, it's very alarming to be speaking in such terms, in such terminologies. But this is the reality. And so, shoulder by shoulder, you see the same thing as will has been sped up so much. They forgot that at some point in time, that the will at some point in time has to begin to retreat, which means it has to slow down. And if it slows down, it becomes conscious of itself. And it begins to take on what? A consciousness unlike before. And so slowly but surely, what you see, you know, this crime is seeping out. Going beyond the little occupied colonies, the little black enclaves, neighborhoods, and controlled environments, while at the same time, to escalate it, if there's going to be some changes, then what do? They land grab. And so they get pushed out into other communities and the other environments of which they've already been in antagonism with. You know, uptown versus downtown, the south side versus the north side, the east side versus the west side. And you look at these, some of these old movies. Now, when the Europeans was doing it, okay, in the 20s, you know, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the Irish gangs and whatnot, they made movies and they glamorized, you know, the gangs of New York. They glamorized. You look at in Chicago, you know, the brothers there, you know, referred to the mayor, former mayor, as Gangster Daily, during the time when Chairman Fred was murdered, 1969, December 4th, Chicago, in the wee hours of the morning. Right? And he referred to him as Gangster Daily because he emerged from the street gangs and he became a politician. So he already had that in him. He already had that. You know, that gang mentality. So it was no problem that he could be part of the apparatus that went into the murder of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark. And so the whole pie, you know, the mass shooting, you know, is taking on a new face, you know, and that face is a non-white face. Because they understand, they expect every day or almost every night a shooting to take place somewhere in Black America. All they need is to be multiple shootings. They used to say multiple people shot, you know, outside of a disco. You know, multiple people shot, you know, in a botched drug deal, you know, whatnot, you know. Multiple, you know, and so forth, always referred to it as that. And because it was a conscious target. It was no at random shooting. It was a conscious targeting. And that's why in the beginning, they never referred to them as mass shootings. So now to do what? Again, it's a chameleon, and they're always able to, you know, to keep constantly transforming themselves into something else. And this is what this is. So now you really knew, now it's mass shootings. So they can take mass shootings and lump them in the statistics and say, oh, look, mass shootings are being committed by black people. So they can mask what a mass shooting has always been, at random killings. Recently in New Orleans, during the parade season, it was a shooting. It was no at random shooting. It was a mass shooting target. It was a conscious target because these little cats, it's around the rest of the country. You know, the wheel is spinning. You know, these beefs, almost to the point of the fratricide. You know, someone calling it a self-inflicted genocide. Right? But now they no longer see it as an incident that took place between police. Now it's a mass shooting. The one in Las Vegas, it was a concert or something. It was an outdoor concert, and this guy had went into the hotel across the way. Literally high-powered weapons, and he had got what's called a strategic vantage point to where everybody could be a target, and he just went to doing what? It was a mass shooting, killings at random. You see what I'm saying? Indiscriminate killer. The targets, moving targets. What are you looking at through us? And even some discrepancies even with that. And so there's a whole another different type of thing with that, and a whole another different level. It's a common thing with these individuals who committed these mass shootings, as we know them. Now I'm gonna mention this one brother before we go. We got time. Aaron Alexis was a brother who was formerly in the military, going through the ranks and wasn't as very conscious. You know, he was good with that thing. So it was like any other person in the military. He tried to become a killer. You know, simple as that. You know what I'm saying? You know, but anyway, his brother had begun to develop these problems. Something had to transpire, but he was conscious of the thing called gang stalking. He was conscious of this ability now on the part of the state, the military-industrial complex, to use technology, studying the brain, the frequency waves, electricity, you know, your body electric, right? And so we developed this thing now, this deadly concept of being able to communicate with when people think this is something right out of the movie. But this is documented, right? And so Aaron Alexis was one of those targeted individuals. You would never hear none of these pundits go into that like we would be willing to do, you know. And so the shotgun that he used, he etched on his weapon, you know, what time it is, you know. Yeah, you know, so it was referred to as ELF. You know, it's an acronym or something like ELF frequency, something like that, electromagnetic, something like that. You know, you look it up, you know what I'm saying? But this brother was one of the victims of it. This brother was one of the victims of it. And it's like something was talking to me in my head. You know, and this is the same thing that the dude that shot up the theater said. And a number of them, and people like, man, if you go with this conspiracy shit, man, this is what far she's making shit up. No. This is a thing that, because Malcolm, we teach us, and certain individuals think, they get us to think the unthinkable. And so tonight we're thinking the unthinkable because we it's an attempt to raise our consciousness as a nation of people who are still subjected to the various mechanisms of domination and control on the part of the state. You know what I'm saying? On the part of these capitalists who have to keep constantly perpetuating themselves. The chickens have come home to roost. They know it. All of us just don't know, or most of us just don't know. A lot of us do. And some of us not able to articulate it so precise and so intricate as others. But some of us do have an idea. But we're going to stop here, and we just hope that we're able to get through, make some sense, the topic, you know, the black man being the scapegoat of crime in America. And so stay tuned next week for another show, In Defense of the People Radio, brought to you by People's Political Party. I'm one of your hosts, Chairman Nat, my other co-host, Brother Motherland, our Minister of Defense, and our assault technician on the ones and twos, you know what I'm saying, our Minister of Communication, our sister Amina Oshun. And so on that note, we say black power and all power to the people and you who rule. We out of here.
In a little tent, open just like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know change gon' come. Oh, yes it will. It's been too hard to live it, but I'm not afraid to fight. I know change gon' come. Oh, yes it will.